open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3214. This was the bill that we didn't have time to get through everybody on the list, so I've got Marianne Nash, Mark Nystrom, and Bob Rindy to come and talk from the other day. And that's all I have on the list. Is that intentional? Nobody else here for this? Okay. Marianne, I've got you first.
And alone?
That's what's on my sign-up sheet.
Perfect. Chair Klim, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here with the Oregon Farm Bureau to testify on House Bill 3314. Mostly just wanted to make a quick comment on the record. Our primary concern with this bill is whether not requiring some of those rural lands where the use has not been in a high-intensity use and it's surrounded by farmland, not requiring those lands to go through the exception process could end up having detrimental impacts on adjacent farmland properties. So our primary concern is more of those rural lands that have lands kind of in blocks that aren't zoned to EFU but have been in low intensity uses, and increasing the intensity of those uses without going through the exceptions process could result in adverse and unintended consequences to neighboring farmlands and lands zoned for EFU.
So I don't really know who I would ask this, but well, maybe Bob will know. Let's hear Bob's testimony, and then Mark's not here, which is the person I would probably ask. It's about, I want to ask some county process, but Bob might know. So go ahead, and then we'll come back to it and see if Nystrom shows up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob Rindy from the Department of Land Conservation Development, and I did give you some testimony on this bill. You know, our concern, and that I've really primarily noted in the testimony, is this is written extremely broad. I heard for the first time the other day Dave Honeycutt's explanation of a property in Washington County that may be the issue, but it is clear to us the bill doesn't really address that, but has much bigger implications. The exceptions process is very fundamental to the land use system and the protection of farm and forest lands. And there are a myriad of detailed rules that I certainly don't want to take your time on with today, but it's long-standing law, very important law, where certain exceptions, when they are changed from how they have been initially, that a new exception is required. I'll mention, for example, that many times landowners apply to the county for what they call a reasons exception. They have good reason to have a particular use that isn't allowed on farmland or forest land. The law is quite clear. When that is approved, and it frequently is, the zoning for that property must limit it to the use that they needed the exception for. If there is a later a proposal to change that use, often maybe in a completely different way, that reasonably is a new exception. This bill would pretty much erase all of those rules in our administrative rules, and we would be left with no process for that. We would have to come up with some new way to make sure that when an exception is taken for a certain purpose, that later there's a major change in that. I've noted a second problem with this. The term "has never been zoned" is quite vague in this proposed bill. I don't know whether it means land that was never zoned prior to Senate Bill 100 in 1973, whether it means farm zones that were in existence at that time are included in that, whether we have records for those. More importantly, a lot of federal land, for example, is unzoned, has never been zoned. That land is put into private hands in regular process that the feds have, and there's other public lands where that happens. We would not want to see the effect that because those lands had never been zoned as farm use, that there is no ability for counties to use the exceptions process. I've also noted that in exception areas throughout rural reserves and urban reserves as well, and we've had a long conversation about that even just last Tuesday, there are restrictions on exceptions. That was part of sort of the deal that established the process for urban and rural reserves. And we've had a very long set of conversations, two quite contentious rulemakings when Richard Whitman was our director, about this. But in exception areas in rural reserves, there is a very careful restriction on new uses because those are special farming areas and those uses typically have effects on farmland. This bill would erase our ability to control those in the way that we currently do. I'm certainly not looking forward to coming up with some new way if there is some new way. And then finally, I noticed that there are counties where there are lands that are farmland or typically, but the zoning is not a farm zone. For example, the zoning says aggregate mine. When that mine is going to be reclaimed, that land presumably hadn't been zoned as a farmland. Is the intent of this bill that exceptions process is not available for reclamation of those sites? Because I do believe that's an unintended consequence. We think these are just examples of unintended consequence of coming up with this very broad way to change statutes because of one property in Washington County. And so those are the concerns I came to talk about today. I'll be glad to stop there and take questions.
Questions? Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Bob, it might be helpful for the committee to hear how some rural residential farm forest lands were originally zoned during their first comprehensive planning processes in the counties and acknowledgement. Because those lands were identified legislatively as exception lands from the beginning and they were never zoned EFU lands. And that might get to part of the nut we're trying to wrestle with here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Rep. Helm. That's my understanding as well. I wasn't back here in all of those days, but that indeed, in the initial acknowledgement of county land use plans throughout the state, and today I've heard the number of about 1 million acres of land are now exception lands. They're comprised of farm and forest soils. They either weren't zoned, and part of my concern is they might have been zoned with something called a farm zone. But at any rate, at the point where we got into this in the late 70s and early 80s, counties eventually took an exception to those and zoned them as rural residential or rural commercial or industrial, but they never in the in-between period were zoned as farmland. I believe that was your question.
Thank you.
And so I think all of those lands are somehow implicated in this bill, but again, that to us the intent of this bill is very unclear.
How are they implicated?
Well, I think those are lands that were probably good examples of lands that were never zoned as farm and forest, as the main statement of the bill declares. And in many cases, if somebody seeks a rezoning of those lands, there would be instances where a new exception is required. And I believe that is possibly the situation that Dave Honeycutt alluded to the other day, although I'm a little concerned that the property he was describing was in rural reserve, which is sort of a different matter. But so I think those are the lands that the intent may have been to sweep in. I'm simply pointing out many other lands that might also be swept in, and as well that our policy on those lands, those 1 million acres, indeed, we have used the requirement for a new exception in order to make sure that as new uses are proposed for those lands, there's an evaluation of impacts on surrounding farm and forest land.
So that goes to my question I was going to ask, and I still don't see anybody here who can answer it, so you might be my best chance. When the county has a zone change application, is there no consideration given to the effect of the zone change on the surrounding properties?
Mr. Chair, there is, because right now our rule requires in many cases for that to be a new exception. The exception process has as its fundamental requirement that you consider impacts on surrounding forest lands. So that's
I know it
method.
Does, but what about just a straight zone change? Non-exception land.
If there's a zone change that's not an exception area, but is, for example, farm or forest,
or not unincorporated areas just outside of Salem, and somebody wants to go from residential zone to, you know, some sort of business. Is there no opportunity for neighbors to weigh in about the you know, at the county commission level when they're doing that? Because it's not in the city, so it's being done by a county commission.
Mr. Chair, I believe, yes, there is. It's a little more oblique than if it was an exception area. If it's something else and it's changing, a zone change is a comprehensive plan amendment, and in that process, the county is required to address the goals, and those goals include Goal 3. So they would have to, in some manner, determine what impacts are to Goal 3 farmland.
So, because that's essentially what I think, if the, whether the unintentional bringing in of all these other people or not got resolved, and we're talking now about Howell's Nursery, if they had a zone change, I think it was to go from rural residential to rural industrial, the concern that Farm Bureau mentioned is if all around them there are farms and you don't use the exceptions process as a way to do it, is there some way for the people to weigh in and the county commission to modify the limitations to which this new zone would allow them, some sort of place, time, and manner restrictions or something like that? And that's what I'm trying to get at. Is there really truly no option for sideboards on the use of the property other than the exceptions process? And, you know, obviously if they had to get a conditional use permit, there would be. But if it's just a straight zone change, which I think would be the next step, I'm trying to figure out if it's really as absent of opportunities for the neighbors as you'd be worried about.
Mr. Chair, currently that option exists in our rules at OAR. I decided in 660-04-018. But those rules, in order to provide that opportunity to all the neighbors and others, those rules simply require the exception process. If this bill were to pass, we would have to come up with a different method to do that, because I don't think that if this bill passes that our rule is valid anymore, and we'd have to have a different rule.
And are there other types of exceptions processes that would potentially be applicable, but just not the farm and forest goals?
Yes.
That's what they're shooting for. It's not necessarily to get out of the exceptions process, it's to get out of them to farm and forest, since that's not what the property is.
Well, I think we could have, and maybe at some points in the past, indeed, the rule may have been written this way so that there were other ways to get at that. The current way is to simply require the exception, which as a piece of it absolutely requires them to address surrounding farmland. There could be some other ways to do that, but it would require us to rethink the exception process and especially the rules that we have in 018 for how land is zoned and how it changes zones.
I suspect if we tried to narrow this down to apply narrowly, we will get complaints that it's too narrow. Right now, the complaint is it's too broad, so I'm reluctant to even get into that conversation right now because we have a lot of other bills, but that's probably the conversation that needs to happen. I'm thinking with you and Mr. Honeycutt, is there some way to not have this broad brush implication that you're talking about on millions of acres of land that make a clear path for what this place would have to go through? If it's in rural reserves, they may be out of luck anyway. I mean, I don't know exactly where the property is, to be honest. I didn't look into it, but it would be worth having a conversation, I think, if you're not.
Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to have that conversation. I noted in my letter, Dave and I had not had that conversation, so yeah. We were a little bit befuddled on the bill. But we would certainly appreciate having the conversation.
Okay. Any other questions? Well, I know that, well, I've got you all. I'm going to go back to work sessions here. Actually, we're done with the witnesses for this one, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3214 and open a work session on, I got to do them one at a time, probably, don't I? House Bill 3084. Mr. Vice Chair?
Me. Excuse me. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 3/11/15.
Vice Chair Post moves the dash one amendments dated 3/11/15. I will note for the committee that the dash one amendments are probably not the only amendments this bill is going to need on some technical matters that the city of West Lynn raised. And it's really not so much, well, it's a combination of this bill and then the what to do with the money. Like they had a series of questions about the city of West Lynn is the one who would likely be on the hook for administering the funds because they already are doing it sort of on behalf, I think it's West Lynn, isn't it? Yeah, on behalf of Damascus. So they had questions like, well, what do we do if nobody, you know, we can never get the money to somebody because they never show up, where does it go next? So the sponsors of the bills talked with them and talked with some one other party anyway, Clackamas County, who had some issues that they believe can continue to be worked on while this bill makes its way through, and there was no objection to doing that. So not everything that will eventually be covered in this bill is covered right here, but enough that got the people concerned from Clackamas County and the city that would have to deal with the proceeds if the citizens vote to dissolve are fine with it moving from here to the floor, and then they'll keep talking about these other issues because they just came up, I think, 2 days ago or yesterday, and there's no way we can get an amendment done in time, and we're starting to run out of committee time. So, sorry, that's my discussion. With that, is there any further discussion on the dash ones? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Clem, I move HB 3084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves HB 3084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
Representative Gomberg?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holm?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Clem?
Aye. Motion passes. The bill sent to the floor, and we'll ask Reps Kennemer and Fagan to co-carry the bill. Let me open a public or work session on House Bill 3085.
Chair Clem, I move House Bill 3085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Holm moves House Bill 3085 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative McLean.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, this bill allows the people of Damascus to vote.
Yeah, the title sounds that like it's just having the city of Damascus surrender its charter immediately, and instead, if you remember, it was a little bit strange, but what we're doing is referring an act onto the cities to the next regular general election, so it'd be the 2016 election, for them to vote on whether they want to dissolve or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any Vice Chair Holm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think that the folks that have been following this carefully deserve a little bit of discussion before we move this on. I followed this dilemma for the folks in Damascus since the late 90s when I was a staff attorney for Metro. And it does represent a very difficult exercise in democracy. And I just wanted to acknowledge that it's been difficult for the community. There's been a lot of disagreement. And a lot of blaming too, which I think my conclusion after seeing these bills and hearing the final testimony is that I think this is the best chance to go ahead and move forward for this community, and that's why I'm going to be voting to pass this on to the floor. And I appreciate everybody's efforts over the years in wrestling through this. It's not an easy matter to consider expanding your urban growth boundary and trying to accommodate the people that don't want their community to change very much with the inevitable forces of expansion of our urban areas and our economy. So it's not an easy job, and I wanted to acknowledge that. And thank you all for your efforts.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Gomberg?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holm?
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Aye.
Chair Klum?
Aye.
Motion passes. The bill is sent to the floor, and we'll ask Reps. Kenemer and Fagan to co-carry this one as well. And then let me open a public hearing, House Bill, or work session on House Bill 3086.
Chair Klum, I move HB 3086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3086 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? This one's about the money. That was exciting for people. Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
Representative Gomper.
Aye.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Klum.
Aye. Motion passes. The bill sent to the floor, and we'll ask our two colleagues, Representatives Fagan and Kenemer, to carry this co-carry this one as well. Thank you. Thanks. You bet. Yep. Okay. Back to public hearings. We had House Bill 3368 with some folks here to testify on it. We had the two folks from Clackamas County that were here and couldn't come back go the other day, Mitch and Robin, who were from the Brightwood community, I think. So let me reopen a public hearing on House Bill, or open a public hearing on House Bill 3368 and ask Marianne Nash, Mary Kyle McCurdy, and Michael Morrissey to come up. We still have a LC here, so please. He was from Hood River County. He was like the planning commissioner, and he talked.
Mm-hmm, he did.
Okay. Welcome. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Chair Klum, members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, here again representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. We are here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3368. 3368, as written, would essentially allow all manner of commercial activities in EFU zones, many activities of which were likely considered for conditional use approval and not allowed by the legislature because they are incompatible with uses and farm zoning. And so as it's written, it is incredibly broad and has a significant ability to impact negatively existing farming operations in the area and encourage non-farm uses in farm zones. We understand that there may be some amendments coming on the bill and are certainly willing to look at those and have conversations around those. But as written right now, to allow outdoor home occupations in an EFU zone with no restrictions would be a tremendous deviation from existing practice and tremendously disruptive to the intent and purpose behind EFU zoning and protecting farm uses in those areas. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay. Let's go through the panel and then do questions. Mary Kyle, I've got you next.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Klum and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I wanted to make a comment after Representative Helm made a comment about where his daughter was going to be married, which is my daughter's going to be married at a facility on the Central Coast, and I can tell you exactly which one it is.
That will only get me in more trouble.
It's in your district. We also oppose the bill, but it does sound like it can be modified. As you've already heard described, and we've submitted testimony to this effect in writing, the home occupation list is very long and broad, and this is too broad for what we understand is the purpose and direction of the bill or the intent behind it. And it seems to us the proper change is for Hood River County to modify its ordinances to incorporate provisions of the winery and agritourism bill that it already passed regarding events on farmland. Thank you.
And Michael.
Chair Klein, committee, I'm Michael Morrissey with DLCD. We did submit some written testimony at the end of your last hearing, so I'll keep it really short. First of all, we just want to acknowledge the work that the legislature did several years ago that created opportunities, new opportunities for events, predominantly on ag land and at wineries. And
agritourism.
Yeah, thank you. Agritourism and wineries. I'm dealing with too many bills today. And frankly, that's probably the opportunity we think that the county ought to take. Many counties have adopted statutes related to those provisions. Hood River County has not. And the second thing I would say is I think most people acknowledge the bill was written more broadly than intended. And as written, it would allow anyone who has a dwelling on a farm zone parcel to do a very wide range of commercial events only because the commercial events under home occupations aren't really defined at this point. So it isn't so much that everything's allowed because it's named. A lot of things may be allowed because they're not named. So with those two items, I think the best route, frankly, to go here is to adopt the existing provisions on ag land for wineries and agritourism and see if that can work for a number of people who would like to do this in Hood River County. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I'll just comment. I was married in Hood River, actually. Our wedding was on a, at the time, I don't even know what it was. It's a piece of EFU land that was grandfathered in, and it's my cousin's home. And now there's a bed and breakfast there. And it, I think, also now has two Measure 49 lots that are available as well. But what I've found is there's something else going on in Hood River County, because my cousin, who's a big realtor in town, has complained to me about still not being able to do events. And I said, we passed something 2 years ago. And he said, yeah, can you give me more information? I did. And for whatever reason, their county commission hasn't or doesn't want to adopt it. And that's the tough part, I think, for the legislature, is if there's a venue and their county commission doesn't want to do it, to allow, I think it's up to 18 events per year without even with a pretty basic permit, and then it's maybe 25 with a more advanced hearing or something. I don't know what to do about that, because it's awkward then when the legislature is asked to find another way to accomplish the same thing because the county commission doesn't want events. And so we create another way for events that would empower an individual property owner, but the county commission doesn't apparently want to have this tool. It's very strange. So anyway, I'm going to talk with Representative Johnson about that, because to me, it's not just this issue for weddings. There's other kinds of events that if they would adopt 968, people would be doing already. I know, because I hear about it every time I go up there. And it's sort of, I don't know what the issue is. It's just sort of, I don't know what the debate is about.
Sure, Clem.
Yeah.
Two issues. One would be that the home occupation provisions are allowed on farm forest and forest zoning as well, whereas these events a legislature we're talking about are only on agricultural land.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just stop there.
I should have asked the Hood River. He was the planner who was here. You want to come up and talk about... Yeah, sorry, I was calling for you earlier and missed that you had come in.
Chair Clem, Mark Nystrom from the Association of Oregon Counties.
Yeah.
I think that there's been a transition in leadership in the planning department at Hood River County. So John, who was here last time, just was hired in the last 6 months. So I think some of those issues will be addressed. AOC supports the concept behind this bill. What we want to see is the ability to run weddings at wineries, in agritourism, but in bed and breakfast as well. So I think that was one of the subtleties that was going on here. But I will look into why Hood River County hasn't adopted the winery bill regulation.
So there's two different ones. There's...
Right.
3280, I think, was the winery bill, and 968 was the farms, which I would have preferred they were just one. I'm going to get somebody from the wineries running in here any minute, but I would prefer it was just one statute for events, but whatever. I lost. The 968 in particular is the one that I think probably in this particular instance, because I don't think this is a winery that he's talking about, yeah, I would love to hear what the issue is.
Yeah, Chair Clem, I'll follow up and get back to you.
Yeah,
but we understand that the bill as written is too broad and needs to be amended.
Okay, Great.
Okay, thank you.
We'll talk with Representative Johnson about that. That's all I've got on this one from carryovers. And anybody else here on this that I just don't know about? Okay, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3368 and open a public hearing on House Bill. Let's do Representative Helms while we've got him here, and then we'll do the other two after that. Do you want to go over there?
Yeah.
Kind of exciting. Okay.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For your record, Ken Helm, District 34. This bill is intended to be a fairly simple exercise in defining the term private park as it appears in the statute governing counties, ORS 215, both in the marginal land counties, which is ORS 215-213, and then the non-marginal counties, ORS 215-283. This comes out of some of my work as a hearings officer, where folks that want to do some very active types of recreation on their farmland that either would immediately change the farmland or over time change the farmland in a way that would be very difficult to return that land into agricultural use, want to do things like have paintball facilities and motocross tracks and so forth on the farmland. It creates a lot of discomfort among neighbors. It creates potential dust, odor, and nuisance issues that are very contentious, and these have been some of the cases that generated some of the largest crowds when I was a hearings officer, and the most contentious. And the problem is, the private parks component of the statute was intended, as it sounds, to be a place that mimics a public park, in that it's a place of passive recreation, a place where you could picnic, throw a frisbee, informally kick the soccer ball around or play wiffle ball or whatnot, hike, birdwatch, and so forth. And so the intent of this is just this change is just to close that loophole. I've worked with the various interests that might have a part to play in this, and I think I've got everybody to neutral, which is always a good thing. One of the components of the bill as amended, and I think our committee administrator posted the Dash 1 amendments on OLIS. Don't bother looking at those. There will be a Dash 2 amendment that both the Farm Bureau and Mr. Honeycutt drew to my attention, an unintended consequence in the way that LC drafted the Dash 1s, and I've already sent Dash 2 amendments to LC, and I think that it gets to the problem. One of the things that we are trying to do is to limit the restriction on private parks to high-value farmland, so that, and I'm disappointed that Representative McLean isn't here, because in part this is to get at some of the difficulties in having events or have facilities on farmland in eastern Oregon, where it's very hard sometimes to find some amount of agricultural use around which to have your wedding events. So the intent here is to restrict the limitations on private parks to high-value farmland and not apply it to all the other EFU land in the state where you have class 5, 6, 7 soils. And I think by doing that, I'm not meaning to say that the stresses around having private parks in different parts of the state on the east side of the mountains isn't still there. It's a more nuanced and complicated conversation to have, probably best left for another time. So this is a baby step, and maybe we'll get to the concerns that Eastern Oregonians have about private parks and EFU lands at a different time. So dash twos are coming. They'll probably be available next week. I had hoped just to get this in a hearing today, get it in the hopper so that we can continue to talk about it.
Thank you. Does the... I'm just reading the way the bill is structured. This might just be LC moving things around. Does the portion about yurts that's deleted just move it to another area, or is
that's
it...
been completely undone in the dash one?
Oh, okay.
Yes, that was a attempt by LC to clean up the statute by moving definitions to one place, but I had exactly the same reaction. So for folks that are following this, no, we're not doing anything to yurts. They're not going away. And same for campgrounds. So everybody can take a deep breath.
I'll let my... I have a yurt on a EFU piece of ground that has been zoned EFU. Even though it's in the forest, it's 1 acre along in between the road and the river, way out in the middle of Douglas County in the forest. But for some reason, it's zoned EFU. We think because across the river, there is real farmland, and it was owned by the same person. So it just crossed over and grabbed this one little piece. And anytime I call Douglas County to ask them, they ask me about, like, my cattle. It's EFU grazing. I said, well, it's 1 acre of forest. There are no cattle there. And so then they asked if my yurt is for storing my farm equipment. I said, it's not... I said, no, it's not. And so they finally said, as long as you don't put a permanent foundation, no blah, 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 you can put it up, and no one lives in there more than 90 days a year or something like that. So then they told me I could put it up. But I figured you were doing away with it right there, so I'm going to go pack up this weekend and spend my end of my spring break getting it taken down.
Yeah, do it.
I don't have to do that.
Apparently. Move quickly.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions? We've got three other folks that you can pepper with questions if you have.
Thank you.
Okay. And that's a different bill. Mary Ann, Michael Morrissey, and Dave Honeycutt. Okay. Which one is that? Oh, it has to go to revenue. Okay. Mary Ann, I've got you first.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Marianne Nash from the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2829. I will not reiterate all of the reasons that Vice Chair Helm gave for the importance of this bill and the issue that it's trying to address, but needless to say, we are very supportive of these efforts and appreciate Representative Helm's efforts in bringing forward this bill. And we agree that the larger discussion still needs to be had around private parks, but appreciate the step toward the limitation for high-value farmland and view that as an absolute step in the positive direction. So thank you, and I will take any questions.
Okay, Michael.
Chair Clement, committee, Michael Morrissey again. Officially, we're neutral on the bill. We haven't received permission to support it, but we are supportive of the concepts here. The issue of active versus passive activities on resource lands has been an ongoing one for a long time, especially where those lands adjoin urban growth boundaries, which isn't the case here necessarily, but I think this is a step in the right direction to bring a little definition. And again, if you go back and look at the work that was done on activities prior, this is a next step, and I imagine there will be more. So we think it's heading in the right direction.
Mr. Honeycutt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. To the original bill, we were heck no with the dash two amendments that Representative Helm is proposing. He's been kind enough to share those with me. We still have concerns, but it's a much better bill with the dash twos that take out the definition of, or that apply the limitations only to high value farmland. The picture I handed out is a picture of some, we use this term loosely, farmland in Deschutes County. I don't think Deschutes County would want to call this farmland, but the state's definition of agricultural land in Goal 3 requires them to call this farmland. This is 200, I've got 216 acres of this. A guy by the name of Shepherd owns it. We're attempting to qualify a private park on 1.5 acres of this 216 acres in Deschutes County. for the sole purpose of holding 18 wedding events every, or events. They may not be weddings. They may be anniversaries or something like that. The Deschutes County has enacted Senate Bill 960, and so they do have the wedding events provisions in Senate Bill 960. But those provisions, if you recall, I think Representative Witt was serving at the time, and I know you were, Mr. Chair. Those provisions only apply if you can prove that the use is incidental and subordinate to the farm use that's going on the property. On 216 acres of this, the only farm use that can be made on this, they've got 10 head of cattle, and that's all that they can have. And the county is concerned about the 10 head of cattle that they have because it interferes with the Goal 5 sensitive deer winter range overlay that's also on the property. And so anything beyond 10 head of cattle, they can't do. So Senate Bill 960 won't work for them because they can't demonstrate that the wedding events, which they're proposing, which, by the way, don't involve no new structures, and will occur during one a week during the 18 weeks during the summer when the deer are off at higher elevation, or else the county wouldn't approve that. All of that required, under the original bill, that would have been prohibited. Under the amendments to the bill, since we're taking out non-high-value farmland, which, I don't know why Deschutes County calls this farmland at all, except that the state makes them, we wouldn't be able to do this. So with the amendments, that's a big help. But just understand that Senate Bill 960 did two things. Number one, it required the wedding events to be incidental and subordinate to the farm use. So on properties like this, you can't qualify. And number two, it did nothing to limit the other potential ways to try and get other uses. So you can use a private park or a home occupation or something else. If it were otherwise, it would be hard for ranchers to lease their property for their hunting rights because they'd be limited to 6 events a year, and that's certainly an event. And so we tag teamed with the Farm Bureau. This was before Mary Ann got here, but we tag teamed with the Farm Bureau to make sure that the language in 960 was clear, that you can continue to try and find ways to conduct events outside of the confines of Senate Bill 960. That was an important point that was hammered into the negotiations on Senate Bill 960. So 960, the wedding event provisions don't work for everybody. I'm sorry, Representative Helm, I didn't mean to use the soapbox on this particular bill, but my point is, when we do these things and they have an impact on stuff like this, we need to be careful because you can call, the state can force people to call this farmland. We can fertilize these rocks. We can pour water on these rocks. We can love these rocks for the entire growing season, which is short in Deschutes County because they don't have many frost-free days. And at the end of the growing season, we have cold, wet, well-fertilized rocks. Okay, so they can make us do these things, but it has a real impact on the people that actually live there and are trying to make some kind of reasonable use on their 216 acres of rocks.
Very, very good testimony.
Sorry for the tirade.
Kind of what?
I have two observations, Mr. Chairman. First of all, we have statutes in this state against loving rocks. And secondly, this land looks like it would be quite an event if one ever tried to go yurting on these rocks. So.
Oh, and speaking of that, the yurt bill—that was another fight from back. I think that was 97 or 99. That was before Michael was there. That was Ron Eber.
Yeah, the problem, of course, is until counties use their remapping authority, we gave them a big look and actually get some of these things changed that aren't really farmland. You have to imagine both extremes. Like when we talk about farmland, I'm thinking of just beautiful, in one side of my brain it's this beautiful picturesque row crop, and in the other it's this. And until, while they're all still being called EFU, it's pretty hard to make distinctions except to pick things like high value or soil types or something, because this is obviously not what I think of when I think of as EFU land in particular. Okay. Any further questions at the moment? Great. Thanks. House Bill 2829 being done with my little list. I'm going to close the public hearing on it. We'll wait for those dash twos. And let me open the public hearing on, do you want them both at the same time? House bills, yeah, no, maybe. 3222 and 3223. And ask Mr. Chandler to come up. And we're going to. Why don't you explain? You know, we have enough time and not so many people. Why don't we just do one at a time?
Okay.
Why don't you just explain 2222, unless they're so interrelated that it's better to explain them both.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, other than the fact they're both fine bits of public policy to which you should pay close attention, they're not intertwined at all, really.
Okay.
And they both fiddle around with ORS 197, but then that covers a broad bit of the waterfront. Did you want to start with 3222, Mr. Chair?
Actually, let's do the other one, because I only have Aaron to talk about that one and you.
3223, John Chandler, for the record, Oregon Home Builders Association. This deals with expedited land divisions. Expedited land divisions are a, as the name implies, a form of land division different from regular land divisions or limited land use decisions. So they're a separate carve-out. We did this back in the 1990s. Bob Stacey, currently Metro Councilor at that time at the City of Portland as their planning director. And the underlying intention of an expedited land division under current law is that if you propose a developer comes in with a project that is 80% or more of the base density, which is what the planning system is geared towards increasing density of development, then they could qualify for this expedited process. And the expedited process is, in fact, expedited. It's a 63-day local approval period, if I remember correctly, very limited local appeals, and no appeals beyond that. And the idea being that if you're bringing in a project that conforms with existing zoning and hits this density target, so we're not encouraging lower density projects, then that's exactly what the system says it ought to be doing, and so we think that was a way to get it to go. That passed the legislature. It's been on the statutes since the middle 90s. It has not been used very often, and there's a variety of reasons for that, and I won't need to go into them because I'm not entirely sure which one was dispositive. What we're trying to do with this bill is two things. We're trying to, and I have some dash one amendments that have been prepared. They're not on OLIS yet, but we'd be asking to move those forward. And if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, I'll speak to those just in concept since you don't have them in front of you. But the idea behind this is to do two things, and the amendments will address this as part of these. One is to shift the burden. Right now, the burden is on the applicant to ask the city if they can do an expedited land, or the county, the approving entity, if they can do an expedited land division. I think it's safe to say that our friends in local governments aren't wild about expedited land divisions, notwithstanding the fact that my co-conspirator back in the day was the planning director of the City of Portland, and I'm not quarreling with that, but it is an important tool to get higher density projects built on a faster track. So instead of having the applicant ask, and a lot of times the applicant may not know, these have been sort of languishing, it would switch it to have the city tell them. If you bring in a project that's 80% more density, the city tells the applicant, we can process you as an expedited land division and allow the applicant the chance to opt out of that and go into the normal process. The amendments have kind of clarify that piece and how the city will provide notice and so on. So that's pretty pro forma language. The other piece that the amendments will do, as you all know and from various conversations in other fora, affordable housing is quite a subject of conversation this session. I'm having a delightful time in other fora on that very topic. We're proposing an amendment in the dash ones that will add, in addition to the 80% minimum density requirement, affordable housing. What I put in the dash one is either be sold or rented to people making between 80% and 120% of median income. Never mind the density, ought to get a similar treatment. That if we're going to try to promote things that we want to promote, ought to go through the system faster. And at the risk of channeling my inner Honeycutt, Mr. Chair and members, I will point out that I've been doing this quite a while, and it is
constant. Wait, 1 second. Sorry, between 80% and 120%
of median income.
What if you're lower than that?
I'm open to it could be 0% to 120%.
Like every legislator, for example.
Mr. Chair, this committee doesn't have enough time to discuss career possibilities of legislative candidates. Yes. Although, now separate issue. The at the risk of channeling my inner Honeycutt, it is still a fact after 40 years of comprehensive statewide land use planning in Oregon and innumerable awards from the American Planning Association and others for our foresight and forward thinking, it is still easier in pretty much every city in Oregon to do a single-family detached house on a relatively large lot. That's the default. So anything that isn't that, be it a duplex, a triplex, a multifamily, a granny flat, a mixed use, a neo-traditional, alley loads, you name it, everything else gets to crawl through broken glass at the local level trying to get permitted. Expedited land divisions, back when we did them in the first place, were an attempt to change that dynamic so that, as with anything, the thing you want to have happen ought to be the default. The things you don't want to have happen or would sooner see fewer of ought to be the difficult thing. We have that backwards here, I believe. This is an attempt to try to change that dynamic a little bit. That's my testimony on 3223. We would like to have the dash ones introduced and proceed from there, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions at this point for Mr. Chandler? Why don't you stay put and have Erin come up in case we have some after she's done carving you up.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Erin Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll keep this very brief. I'm reviewing the dash ones at this point, and I need to run it by my certified smart people who do this on the day-to-day to recognize if there are any impacts that I'm not foreseeing by switching the process around from having an applicant request to us notifying every applicant that comes in. Just not sure how many division applications occur on a daily basis and what kind of analysis will be added to that. But it's just a matter of my getting the dash ones to the people who know best. But at this point, I understand the concept that Mr. Chandler has presented, and I am not opposed. I'm just unsure of the long-term impacts. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Sounds exciting. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none. I will close the public hearing on three. Do you want to stay, Erin? Are you on the next one? Might as well just stay there. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3223. Open another exciting bill, House Bill 3222.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is an exciting bill. Let me explain it to you. I'll read it in verbatim, if you don't mind, along with the Dash 96 amendments, which I have prepared. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on behalf of HB 3222. This is actually a tweaky bill. I won't try to pretend it's particularly exciting. We also have Dash 1 amendments prepared for this. We may or may not want to. We may have another set, because I forgot to remove some language about attorney's fees that are in the base bill when I met with the Legislative Council's office. Not our intention to put an attorney's fees kicker in here. And this, as you all know, Harrison Conley, who was the main drafter for land use legislation, resigned earlier this session. And so some of the things that we're tweaking around here are outgrowths of I think they're kind of transitional issues. In 3222, for example, when you see the dash twos, a lot of the stuff at the beginning, which I know caused people, including myself, anxiety, because it would have changed the definition of needed housing and made it only applicable in jurisdictions over 25,000, which was absolutely not my intention. I have the vaguest idea why it ended up in the base bill. The dash ones will take that back out. There are two things we're attempting to do with the dash one amendments and with this bill. The base bill has one of them, and that is on, if you're reading along at home, on page 2, line 12, it's a very obscure little reference that says ORS 197522 is added to and made a part of ORS Chapter 197. Those of you who have been following this issue may wonder why we have to say that about a piece of statute that's already in ORS 197, and the reason is the language in ORS 197522, which is reproduced here with some tweaks to it, that was another bill we passed back a long time ago, and it says basically that local governments are supposed to approve projects that match the existing zoning and comp plan subject to reasonable conditions. They're not just supposed to deny them. And that worked pretty well until the LUBA in a year or four back. I don't recall where the case came from, doesn't really matter, and it's a sort of analysis that only fools lawyers, found that because that language was added back in the 90s in a bill dealing with moratoria, that language in ORS 197522 only applied to cases involving moratoria. That was not the intention back then, and it seems kind of silly considering there hadn't been a moratoria case filed in Oregon for 20 years, but there you had it. This language that on line 8 that I mentioned, or line 12, excuse me, on page 2 is attempting to say, well, no, that language down in the section, part of the section that is in the moratorium statute applies throughout ORS 197522. In other words, that if you're bringing in a project from a developer standpoint that matches up with city planning and zoning, county planning and zoning, they're supposed to approve you unless they can't condition it to the point it's acceptable. That, I think, is what the policy was supposed to be. This is simply fixing a court case in that context. The other change that we're making, and this is one I suspect some folks will have some concern about, and we certainly want to make sure that we're doing it right and not wrong, is to change the language in ORS 197-296, which deals with urban growth boundary analysis, and this is what I attempted to do, and I may or may not have gotten there. The attempt was to say that local governments can count in terms of the needed housing analysis, and you'll remember what that is, that they're supposed to go through, find out how much they can build in order to decide how much they need to add to the boundary and so forth, that they can count land that's based on clear and objective standards. And every jurisdiction is supposed to have a clear and objective path for needed housing. In other words, one that the developer knows, if I do the following things in the following sequence, I can get approved. And then they can have all the discretionary paths they want, where it's a more of an open process of how about this, how about that, as long as they have that clear and objective path. Our thinking is that for analysis purposes only, and this is not what can be approved, but analysis purposes for UGBs, they should be allowed to count that which we know we can do. So if there's a 10-unit zone, for example, that has a possibility of going up to 20 units on a discretionary process, but a 10-unit that is allowed as of right, our thinking is, and this is what the department used to do back in the early 80s when they were approving comprehensive plans in the first place, is you get to count the 10 units. If you're a city looking at that, you have a 10-unit zone, you can count 10 units because the developer can ask for that and get it. The 20 units you ought not be allowed to count because that may or may not happen. And the significance would be only in the urban growth boundary analysis, but it's very significant there. So those are the two changes that we're making with 3222, with the exception, as I said, of taking out the attorney's fees piece that we don't intend to move forward. And with that, I'll close and take questions.
Okay, Aaron, and then Bob, do you want to join us while we're chatting with us?
All right. Chair Clem, members of the committee, again, Erin Doyle on behalf of League Oregon Cities. I've been given the dash ones. I'm going over them with two of our jurisdictions in particular that are usually impacted when we talk about UGB analysis to determine if they have any concerns about how we count in supply. And then I have raise an issue about discretion related to natural hazards that are discovered post-comprehensive plan that might require reducing density, and I think Mr. Chandler and I are on the same page when it comes to that. And other than that, I appreciate that he's taken out most of this stuff that seemed very controversial and difficult for us. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I have been in some discussions with Mr. Chandler about what he intends with this bill rather than what it originally said. So I came here to speak mostly to what he's trying to do. And I want to first say that the department has a high priority to make sure that local governments provide standards for review of housing that are clear and objective and don't have the effect of precluding needed housing. And that's really at the core of all of this. And there's a lot of details about that. One of the biggest problems with that standard, that requirement, which is in state law and it's in Goal 10 as well, is we used to have, LCDC, used to have a great deal of authority to monitor this, to review zoning ordinances, and to help local governments achieve that. That kind of went away in 85 with the acknowledgement process ending, and then we had it in periodic review, but with the amendments to periodic review in 1999 and 2003, we've got a very, very limited ability to actually affect ordinances, local ordinances, that are not clear and objective. I say that because I applaud Mr. Chandler in trying to find some other ways to try to get there. We know there are communities that don't have clear and objective approval standards. I don't think the way to do that is to have those communities only count as buildable land that is under clear and objective standards, because that would have the unintended effect of meaning that a large supply of land of certain cities I'm not going to mention here would all of a sudden be unbuildable, meaning they have to double their urban growth boundaries, and we don't want to see that as a result of this. Communities are also allowed to have standards for reviewing housing that are not clear and objective. They can have two parallel tracks, and it is then up to the developer to choose which one they want to proceed on. And so I think a lot of the work we've been discussing on how to repair this bill is about exactly how do you count current land in a UGB, how much availability is there for housing when you've got these two tracks? Is it the amount that you could get under the clear and objective track or the other track? And we have committed to try and work with Jenner on that language. I don't think we're there yet with the amendments that you've seen, but if that's the intent of the bill, we are very much behind that. I might take this opportunity to mention on the previous bill, which is also really about ultimately having clear and objective standards and a fast process for affordable housing, and it's part of that core priority that we have. So both of those things are things we're trying to work with him on and achieve.
Okay, questions? Okay, so I've got Mary Kyle and Randy Tucker still. Really?
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm going first because I have to then jet to another hearing where I have to testify, so I'll be brief. I've only during this hearing seen the proposed -1 amendments that Mr. Chandler just described, and been having some back and forth with my colleagues at Metro to try to understand what their implications are. And so it's premature for me to weigh in. I will just say that we've been having a longer, larger conversation with Mr. Chandler and his client and his colleagues in the home building community about how we determine the buildable capacity of the urban growth boundary. And you have another bill that I think is aimed at that question. This amendment seems to be an attempt, but I need to learn more about it and understand the exact wording and what the intent is, to artificially limit the amount of capacity that we can count when we're trying to ascertain how much capacity we have within the urban growth boundary as we go through the process of potentially modifying or expanding the urban growth boundary. Now, the wording is unclear, and I've heard a couple of different things, you know, here in the room. So I want to say that we're certainly willing to talk about this. I do want to note that in Portland, there's another statute that allows, I may botch it, so let me just say that right up front. But there are two areas in Portland, the Central City and the Gateway Regional Center, that are exempted from the clear and objective standards language or statutory requirement. And so if the intent is to say we can count nothing in those areas, that would be a significant problem. If there's a different, more nuanced intent, as I think I may have heard Mr. Chandler describe, then we can have a better conversation. But I just want to express some concern about anything that artificially says, no, you can't count actual capacity that you have for housing inside your UGB when you're determining how much capacity you have. So I'll just put that on the record and leave it open for a future conversation. I didn't have any comments on the underlying bill, just the -1s. I was not going to say anything about the underlying bill, so let me just make that clear.
Good, thanks.
And I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'll just run over to the other hearing room.
Any questions for Mr. Tucker? We're very excited to await the outcome of your conversations.
Thank you.
I would say breathless is where we're at this point.
You mean that was not gripping?
I think we really want to know. I was waiting to hear what happened the other day in your meetings about I think it actually is somewhat, it's sort of a unique, novel approach right now to say we can absorb all of the growth in Portland, and so it's not without controversy. So I am waiting to hear what you say. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director at 1000 Friends of Oregon. We submitted written testimony on the original bill, and I am happy to hear that the home builders and John Chandler have removed the provisions that we were most objecting to, which was exempting cities under 25,000 from the needed housing and the appellate fee aspect. We also just saw, and I was reading on my phone, the amendment that that John Chandler has submitted that has some new language in it that concerns us for the same reasons you've heard Bob Rindy and Metro speak to that we'd like to go back and look at. Again, there is currently an ability in state law for development to occur under clear and objective or discretionary standards. And there's a lot occurring under the discretionary standards. And we should count as buildable land that's actually buildable and being built upon. So we want to make sure the testimony sounded like it wasn't the intent to not count that land, but to make sure it's counted in an honest fashion. So we look forward to working on that language. Or in some other way resolving the matter. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Mary Kyle?
Just have one. Damn. Okay,
okay. So we just stay right there. Let me close temporarily the public hearing because I only have quorum for a second.
Okay.
On House Bill
I'm okay.
3. Yeah?
I'm okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. One question in the form of a comment and something for this group to work on. I've encountered on at least two instances on major applications dealing with complicated multifamily housing development as a hearings officer, an applicant that comes in with a nice discretionary review program at a set density, and then as an alternative argument says, well, if you don't like that one, you got to give me the same amount of density because it's needed housing. And I've ducked that issue twice, but it seems to be a real one. It would be nice to understand whether that could be solved. It doesn't quite seem fair to me to put a local government in a bind in that way that says, if you don't give us our wonderful planned unit development or whatever it is, We're just gonna build this other thing anyway. It seems like they ought to pick a track, stick with it, and see if they can make it work.
Chair Klein, Representative Helm, I think you raised something that is the clear and objective track. Counting it as that may actually result in more capacity, and that takes away flexibility for cities and neighborhoods and developers to work together to configure developments in ways that everyone is fine with. So I think that is actually, be careful what one wishes for. Right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3222 and reopen a work session or open a work session on House Bill 3886 for the purpose of reconsidering the vote. We accidentally sent it to the floor and it has a subsequent referral to revenue. And that's not really allowed to just ignore the subsequent referrals. So I'm looking for a motion to suspend the rules. Never mind. I'm moving that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3086. This motion is not debatable, so don't even think about it. Is there any objection to the motion? If not, the rules are suspended.
Chair Klein, I move that House Bill 3086 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Post moves. No, sorry. Can you withdraw your motion real quick?
I withdraw my motion on what I just said.
I'll move that we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 3086 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? You could debate this one if you want to, but any objection? If not, the motion carries. The measure is once again before the committee. Yes.
All right. Chair Clem, I move HB 3086 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 3086 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to revenue. And you definitely can go. And I think we're done on, with all our bills for today. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Anybody else here that I missed on anything in particular? No? Good. No, Mr. Reinhauer. We could bring up the irrigation district bill while April's not here and then quickly close it and claim that I gave her her day in court, but that would be really rude. So with that, adjourn the committee. Colleagues, have a great in-district day, meeting with your constituents tomorrow, and then a good end of your spring break weekend, and we'll see you.
May I add for please. The record that I'd like to invite the members of this committee, if you happen to own a motorcycle or know where to get one really fast, to come ride with me tomorrow from 10 to 1 through House District 25. We'll be leaving from the Rite Aid parking lot in Kaiser, heading to St. Paul, and then off to Newburgh.
So will you make fun of my little 886 Sportster? It's kind of, it's like it's a little bit small.
I've got a 50cc scooter that's right. We can only go 35, 48. So.
All right. Maybe it's 883. What is it? No, it's 886. It's been a while since I wrote it. Yeah, let me adjourn the committee.
883?
It's 886 or 883? Can I come in? 883? It's 886 or 883? Can I?